Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program. Well, as the oldest continuing institution in Western society, the Catholic Church has survived even the worst of hostilities. Yet the past half century have witnessed an unparalleled collapse in religious life, particularly in Catholic orders. The enemy has proved to be not hostility, but indifference. Tonight, to discuss the future of the religious life, it's a pleasure to welcome Sister Claire Condon of the Good Samaritan Sisters, Brother Jude Butcher of the Christian Brothers, and Sister Nolan White of the Good Shepherd Order, and chaplain to the Medically Supervised Injecting Centre at King's Cross in Sydney. Welcome to you all.
Thanks.
Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Now, before we go on to the topic of the evening, we can't let the headlines of the week pass us by. The Pope has spoken on condoms. Now, we don't know we know the context of the conversation. It was a conversation with a journalist recorded for a long-form interview, which is going to be published as a book. We know basically what he said. Much has been made of the fact that he was giving an example of where it could be morally permissible on the basis of a lesser two evils, where you had perhaps a male having sex with a male prostitute and then a condom was in order because it didn't violate the propagation of life, but it did act to protect the health of somebody. Now, a number of people have commented on perhaps the ineptitude of that analogy, but let's leave that to one side and pick up the issue of where the Pope seems to be introducing a concept of the lesser of two evils, which many have argued for a long time is a very sound argument for dealing with the whole issue of condoms and sexual health anyway. Now, as somebody who has worked in the King's Cross Injecting Centre, this issue of the lesser of two evils must be one of those that that has come across Nolan White's table, has it not?
Oh, look, it's not really something that we talk about all the time, I suppose, Don, but people who are living the lifestyle that those I work with are living, they really have for many years now been thinking about and have been counselled about and advised about taking the sort of precautions that are necessary to prevent the transfer of diseases that just can devastate communities. So the use of condoms is just something that they do. And many of them will not even ever hear of the Pope's comment. I think it's good to hear the Pope talking about the use of condoms in situations that can prevent the transfer of illness and disease. But in the real world, people have moved way beyond that. They're not actually waiting for someone to tell them whether they can or cannot use condoms. They're dealing with day-to-day life and a matter of life and death, and they're making their decisions on the ground.
The whole issue of sex and ethics has been one that's been problematic since the 1960s, since the Humanae Vitae and all this. And that argument about the lesser of two evils or the different philosophical positions has been one which has been vigorously argued, albeit in isolation, in the church since then. I mean, the whole issue of sexual ethics is a lively one and has been a constant one. It's really that the Pope is saying, look, you know, we've been debating this stuff internally for a long time. I'm just opening the debate a little further. Jude, how did you see it?
Well, I'd also put it in a bigger frame of reference, John. And I think we also need to look towards the whole role of the whole sexual intercourse in the context of the different forms of relationships. And at times those relationships are relationships of power or exploitation. And it's very important for the people who are the victims, in inverted commas, of that, to have access to condoms and whatever, to be able to make sure that their health and well-being is respected, at least at a basic level.
So philosophically, this issue of lesser of two evils is a quite proper and legitimate area of debate.
Well, I think, you know, from the beginning of Humanae Vitae, the sensus fidelum in the church has in many respects ignored it.
Yes, the sense of the people has been, oh, look, we're going to get on with life.
It has been. And in some ways you welcome the Pope now beginning to at least raise the issues, even if it is creating some confusion out there at the moment. But for the 30, 40 years, people have lived their lives from their own conscience, and I think that's part of the whole shift in authority within our broader world, as well as within our church, that people will make their own decisions from their own conscience and position of well-being.
It was very interesting. I did a brief scan of Catholic World newspaper opinion on this, and John Allen, who writes on the Vatican for the National Catholic Reporter, and has tended to be very down the middle, he tended to sort of play this down and say, well, look, you know, this is the Pope speaking off the record, or on the record, but to a journalist, not in a sort of, not in his capacity as Pope, but he's really Benedict having a chat. He's just, and played it down. Clifford Longley, who writes for The Tablet, saw it entirely differently. The Tablet being the leading British Catholic magazine, I guess of the sort of centre, liberal centre. Clifford Longley, who writes for The Tablet, said the development was far more significant than a nuanced change in attitude. Longley said, quote, the small concession could easily become a collapse in the whole edifice of Catholic teaching on contraception, and the implication seems to me to be much vaster than even the Pope anticipates. So we've got a range of opinion on this issue, but essentially you're saying, look, we've been there for a long time, we're just owning it now.
And so it might be, let's wait and see. Yes. Does the edifice fall or not?
And while we go on waiting to see and continue the debate, people living life will go on doing what they feel they have to do.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio. John Cleary with you. Our guest this evening discussing the future of the Catholic Church, particularly its religious orders. Claire Condon of the Good Samaritan Sisters, Jude Butcher of the Christian Brothers, and Nolene White of the Good Shepherds, and also chaplain to the medically supervised injecting centre at King's Cross. The reason I asked that partly in the start, and it wasn't just that it was a headline issue this week, but also that in some ways it betokens one of the things I think underpins the recent discussion about the place of orders in the church, and that is the sort of way in which the church has become in some ways dissociated from society, from the real world, and that in some ways people are saying, look, we've got to get back to a connection where people see there's an intimate connection between religious life and life in the real world, life in the community. And has that, do you think, been part of the problem, that for a long time orders have just been seen to drift off there as part of a very old structural institution that's increasingly irrelevant to people's lives? Does anyone want to have a sort of punch at that?
Well, I don't think that's accurate. I think over the last, you know, since Vatican II, since the 1960s, certainly religious life took some dramatic changes, and orders were looking to really get back to their roots, to their founding, charism. And I think, like in the 1940s, 50s, when the numbers were at their peak, Catholics were in a sense the marginalised in society, and so health and education were seen to be the means of bringing them into mainstream. I think,
and you had to look after yourselves because nobody else was doing it.
That's right. And so I think we are now mainstream, and so I think religious orders have handed over the institutions of health and education to very competent lay people, and we're part of the laity, you know, we're sort of jammed in between at times, but we are. The sisters and brothers are part of the laity, and so I think in returning to our original charism, you'll find religious orders in a much more relational way of working in with people in the areas now where the need is, whether it's with refugees, whether it's with homeless people, whether it's at the injecting room, whether it's with the Edmund Rice Centre advocating for people. So they're sort of in places where we're not so visible.
Yeah, I guess it's this question of the founding charism that, I'm wanting to get to, because essentially religious orders depend utterly on people seeing something so compelling about that charism that they want to belong to it. And perhaps one of the dangers of that period of the 50s and the 60s, when everybody was going to church and was all okay, was these things just became accepted. And that charism was just carried there and you expected it to be understood in the DNA of every Catholic kid. But since then, we're in a different period, a different time, and you've actually got to refine the charism of each order in a quite deliberate and conscious way. Like, it's got to be renewed for each generation. It can't be sort of inherited, in a sense, or you've actually got to refine it for yourselves. I think that's true.
Yes, that is true. And but I think that religious men and women religious are out there really living the particular charism of their order. We're just not doing it in institutional ways as we did. And people used to see the institution. I'm not sure that they ever really saw us as people living the relational passion for our mission that we have. So they no longer see the institutions. So they have to see us as individuals. And perhaps we don't reach the multitude of people visibly that we did. But I just know for myself, in the years that I've worked in King's Cross, I'm there for the people who are the on the fringes of society, if you like, and they're the ones I'm there to be with. And if I were to look back over those years, there are hundreds of people that I have met
whose
lives are different.
You demonstrated by being out there in the world, living your charism.
In the pubs, in the gay bars.
What I'm suggesting is, up until perhaps the 1950s, 60s, even into the 70s, it worked the other way. That people had got used for hundreds of years of the orders existing there, and you know, a kid from every family basically went off into the church,
right?
Into the priesthood
in
order.
Yes.
You had big families, and one of them went in. And this whole idea of the individual owning the charism and after living it out in the world rather than in the institution was something that sort of got lost along the way there. And you're in the process of saying, in fact, we've got to refine this, Jude.
Well, taking up Claire's point, I think basically the world needed to be the world of the church in the first instance in the history of Australia, because the church was basically having to create a culture and institutions in which they, as a dispossessed, in a way, people, could actually access the education and the health and the welfare they needed. But then it became a point where they then became part of the establishment of society.
Yes.
And the congregations are now, with the members of the congregations, but also people associated with them, very much connecting with the people who are the voiceless and marginalised now, whether it be here or overseas. I think one of the challenges now is the fact that society doesn't want to hear that voice. Then how do we as religious become with the people who are voiceless? A voice. Not that we take the role of them being the voice, but we actually are a voice with them.
Facilitate.
Yeah. That's right. And I think that's a whole new role for ourselves, but it's also a whole new presence in society, and it's a new presence in church. And I think this is a new narrative. It's a new identity. It's a new narrative identity that has been developed within the church and in society. And society at this point in its history is becoming more governed by fear, which makes it difficult to hear that alternative voice. And I think as religious and with the people associated with us, we need to find ways of singing the new song.
What strikes me as somebody who does a program that looks across a number of different religious traditions is the story I'm hearing about orders in the Catholic Church is similar to what I'm hearing, say, from young Protestants who are saying, we've got to recover the original thing that impelled John Wesley, say, or whatever. We've got to recover that and live it out in our own lives. And they could be talking about sort of a monastic life if they weren't living in a Protestant tradition. So there does seem to be a moment of opportunity here where young people are saying, don't talk to me about your institutions. Talk to me about your authenticity. Talk to me about who you are and what you do.
I think another thing too, John, is that Australia is much more diverse now than it was before. And the church and the congregations need to be continually being open to and changed by the cultures and the range of cultures that are part of society today. And I think that's another way in which the congregations and people associated with them will be agents for change to become a much more inclusive community and nation.
Mm. I guess I could appear to be sort of telling you how to do your job, but what I'm hearing is people who are doing amazingly interesting things, and just the sort of things that young people are saying we want to see the church doing. We want to see the church doing these right and good things, yet the publicity for that isn't getting out there. Noel, in your work in the injecting rooms in King's Cross, there have been so many newspaper articles about should there be an injecting room, shouldn't there be an injecting room, and the discussion about church involvement has flowed along under the radar. But the word gets out there.
Well, I suppose really we're on about the innate dignity of every human person. For me, as a Good Shepherd sister, that's the essence of what I'm on about. And when I'm at the injecting room and I see staff relating to clients, that's what I see. People who are working with those clients with the deepest respect for that person. And I see people responding to that, because my belief is that I don't do anything about changing my life. I don't even think I deserved anything more than I have, unless I begin to feel and understand I deserve something more, my own respect. And the injecting room really is about respecting that every person has a right to good services, good health services, support in their times of struggle. And I see people who carry a great burden. I know that it's difficult for us to have a lot of compassion for people who are using drugs, because we also see the criminal side of their behaviour. But if we are really holders of value, the innate dignity of the human person, then that's based on that person. It's not based on what I do or how I behave. It's that I have got that innate...
See, I hear people around Australia hearing what you're saying, yes, right on. Yet those same people are walking away from the institutional church because they see the institution as not representing that. They see you representing that, but they don't see the institution. And at the moment, still, they identify orders with the institution.
I think in your opening you said we're going through an unparalleled breakdown. I don't think it is unparalleled. I think if you look at the history of the church, the 2,000 years, religious orders have come and gone, and some have survived through hundreds of years. And
yes, there's a pretty rough time between 700 and 1,000 AD there.
There was, yes. And then, like, you had monasticism, but then in the last 500 years, you know, you've had the Francis and the Dominic and the Ignatius. And so I think we're... A new time of refounding is what someone like Jerry Arbuckle writes about. But it's a time of refinding what's at the heart of it. And when people talk about the institutional church, I'm not sure who they're talking about. Are they talking about the clerical church?
I think they're talking about the clerical church, but I think they're also talking about the church they grew up in, which for many of them they haven't been inside in 40 years. And it represents a world that they've just moved away from, whilst they'll look at Nolene and say, you are doing great things. They'll look at the church and say, but I can't buy into that. And
So one of the things I think a lot of people that might not have been in the church for 40 years or whatever are looking for is spirituality. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of religious are actually working it with people in spirituality, whether it's in spiritual direction, retreats, but helping them find their place, their Catholic faith in another way.
One of the things, Judy, that ties in quite closely with that is the observation that the spirituality is intimately connected with service to others. That is, almost giving yourself away to others, the self-effacement for the sake of others. Nolene's referred to it, you've indirectly referred to it. The paradox of that is, doesn't make for a good advertising campaign, does it? It doesn't.
Well, I think it actually is a spirituality of relationships, because I would actually use the word, how do we engage and relate to the other rather than a service or giving to the other? And that spirituality of relating to is very much one of mutuality and deep respect, and realizing that, like, I am learning and growing as they transform me, just like they have the opportunity to learn and grow from my engagement with them. And I think too often we've almost had at times an attitude of people to be dependent upon us, rather than what Nolene was saying. It's very much like, we are all people of God, and we all have this dignity, and we all are basically going to help each other. And the way we come to live and learn and grow in the whole sense of spirituality of relating to each other and relating to God. And Christianity is a spirituality of relationships. Relationships with God, relationship with people, relationship with self, and relationship with the world and the earth.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio. John Cleary with you. Our guests this evening talking about religious orders in Australia. Their own headline, Older, Fewer, But Doing Things in Many New Ways. It's a pleasure to have in the studio Jude Butcher, Nolene White, and Claire Condon. If you'd like to give us a call, 1300 800 222, 1300 800 222. Were you a member of an order? What do you think of religious orders and their place in society today? Did you go to a Christian Brothers school? What observations do you have of your childhood? 1300 800 222. You might like to ask some questions about. Let me give you some facts and figures that. A bit of a stunner, actually. A survey released by Catholic Religious Australia on the 8th of November, this report on religious orders in Australia, said this, that in 2009, there are 8,422 Catholic religious in Australia, 5,927 religious sisters, 884 religious brothers, and 1,611 religious order priests. Now, the median average age of religious in Australia in 2009 was 73 years of age, with religious women making up just over 70% of all religious. And whilst the survey shows that Australia's religious are ageing and decreasing in numbers, they are broadening the types of ministry they're involved in, which has been the essence of the conversation we've been having thus far. 1300 800 222, if you'd like to join us. We've been talking about the way in which orders in some ways these days bear the burden of the institution, and that they have to in fact refine themselves in spite of that. That's been particularly tough for the Christian Brothers, because the Christian Brothers, for good or ill, were identified particularly in Ireland in a number of cases with sexual abuse story. How have you been able to come to terms for that yourself, Jude, and your fellows?
I think that was part of our history, where we basically had to enter the cross and enter that cross with honesty and integrity.
What went wrong, do you think?
I think it's a question, to go back to that point about a spirituality of relationships. I think it might have become a spirituality of work and labour without regard for the people and the relationships and the just general health and well-being in those relationships.
A symptom of a highly clerical church, too?
No, I think a symptom of a of such a commitment to the doing that you actually forgot what to have to under be the basis for the doing.
Mm. Nolene, do you have any observations about that? You've all had to share the sort of what's happened.
I think, like, obviously, when we look back to the past, there are things that orders would do differently if they had that time over again.
There's got to be a fairly bad run, for instance, with, and it's not just the sexual abuse stuff associated with the Christian Brothers. I think of a film a couple of years ago, The Magdalene Sisters. Mm. It's horrific things, and it wasn't about sex abuse, it was just about the way children in some of those Irish Magdalene laundries were treated. And I went to that film, and I came out afterwards, and I was with a friend who'd been to, as a young woman, to a Catholic school, and she said, I've got to go to the loo. And she went to the loo, and she came back after me, out after me, and she said, that was full of women crying.
I said,
I was in the men's loo, it was the same thing.
I think that was horrific for all of us, to see a story like that, to hear a story from people who have found their experiences to be harsh or cruel, but if it is part of our history, we do have to confront that, and we do have to be willing to try and meet the needs of the people who have experienced that. I think it is a bit complex looking back in history. Way back when times were very harsh, life was harsh, institutional life was going to be also harsh and more harsh probably. But that is no excuse.
Was one of the problems for the orders that, and I'm not just talking about Catholic orders, I guess I'm talking about any institution, was when institutions are strong, they tend to carry their present into a future that changes before they're ready for it to change. And so they're still structured for the world of the 1930s, when in fact they're living in the 1980s, and that in some ways they don't move as flexibly or as quickly as the rest of society, and you get caught in a bit of a time warp for a period.
I think that's true, but I think sometimes it's just a matter of just numbers. The churches were providing a lot of the care places at those times,
and no one
and
else
government was.
Yeah.
So if children were brought and left at the door, I'm sure the orders were not going to turn them away, but it was the pure mass of numbers also probably made it almost impossible to give the real care that we would want to be giving today. So there is a lot for us to look back on and regret, but to learn from, and to do what we can do to make sure that those sorts of situations never occur again.
Clear.
And I think tied to it was a little bit around the obsession with numbers, that, you know, many people were joining religious life. There was lots of work to do. As Jude said, the concentration was on the work, not on what's religious life all about. And I think, therefore, we, you know, people weren't necessarily formed well for the tasks that they were asked to do. You know, I've heard sisters talk about having 120 children in grade one, in post-World War II migration areas where 80% of the children didn't have English as a first language. And if they hadn't been trained well, for the classroom or for whatever,
they were just dealing with the issue.
They were dealing, and, you know, things got out of control at times because they couldn't handle the pressure that they were put under.
And that was true even in the state system. I mean, I can remember in the state's high school going into first year at high school, and my French teacher said to the class, I can't speak French, I know no French, I am giving you what I learned an hour ago, each lesson. Now, if it was like that in the state system, it must have been pretty high pressure in the church system.
Learning the lesson the night before.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio. We're talking about religious orders in Australia, a proud history in some ways in helping build and shape some of the great cities in Australia and the institutions of those cities, Sydney, Melbourne, other cities, but also difficult times along the way. What's the future for religious orders in Australia? Average age these days, 73, numbers declining. Is there a place? Talk to people like our guest this evening. You say, gosh, why aren't there more of these people in the world? Well, perhaps there are opportunities. I'm sure at least that's one of the reasons you're here, is it not? Let's take some calls on Sunday night. Spiro in Perth wants to say hello. Hello, Spiro. How are you?
This is the first time I rang you up.
Yes. Well, it's good to have you with us.
Yes. Yeah, so I'm Greek Orthodox.
Yep.
And my grandmother came here from a Greek island in the 1900s. And her father was a priest on the island of Kaphtoristo in Greece.
Yes, because in the Orthodox community, priests can be married.
That's true. I think it's just part of the religion. You have to be married to be a priest.
Yes.
For some reason, I don't know that. But my church is the St. Helena Church in Parker Street in Northbridge in Russell Square. And that's where I go. That's where I go for my, my culture, my religion. That's because that's how I was brought up, you know. But when I went to school, it was Church of England.
Yeah.
And, why I'm ringing, and this is my point, is that religion is actually good for a routine, for people and for culture for people. So if you've got the Greek Orthodox, the Catholics, the Protestants, whoever, and they've got a bond with God.
And you think that's pretty foundational for culture?
Well, yes. They've got a bond with their spirit. Everybody, God is a spirit. He's our spirit. He's the one that keeps me alive every day, you know. And I don't have to go to church to know that, because that's how I was brought up. That's what I learned.
Yep. Go on.
Well, I don't think people should be indifferent about religion. If they're atheists, well, that's fine. Then they shouldn't have an opinion. Whereas some people in other religions have opinion about other religions. And I get confused because my religion is my religion. That's the one I was taught. That's the one I was brought up with. That's the one my grandmother came to Australia to live for, because she couldn't live anymore on the island. That's the story.
Yep. Well, look, let's just pick up a couple of the points you raised there. And this important point, I think, Spiro raises about the way religion shaped culture. And that in some ways we're entering a period, and this is just moving on from what Spiro suggested, we're entering a period in which for the first time we're going to have a culture that in which kids are not profoundly shaped by those values. This in some ways provides an opportunity for those committed to a religious life to say, we present you with something new. But it's also saying something about a culture that's being left behind what's the new world we're venturing into, a post-Christian culture. Perhaps it does take us back to the Dark Ages again, as we were suggesting.
Just to comment upon that, John, I actually think what society offers us is the opportunity to stand tall and express and respect the faith traditions of a wide range of people. And one of the things we need to be conscious of is to be open to the spirit in people rather than to impose a religion on people. And also I think we've found in Australia, with the canonisation of Saint Mother of the Cross, with Mary MacKillop, sort of an openness to the whole wonder of what it is in religion that can inspire people such as Mary MacKillop to do what she did. Now, people will respond to that differently, but it actually offers lessons to the nation as well as to individual people. And as religious and as church, we need to find ways to make sure we do have a presence in the public space and are able to make sure that the spiritual and the religious is given the space and the voice that it needs.
Let's take another call. Spiro, thank you for your observations. We'll go to Dan in Sale. Hello, Dan. Welcome to you.
Yeah, John, how are you?
Yeah, good. What would you like to say?
Look, I'd like to say that I was educated by the Christian Brothers. All my education experience through primary and also secondary schooling, I had not a problem with them. I thought that most of the fellows teaching me were a great attribute and a great example of manhood. You there?
Yep, we are. Why? Okay. Could I ask you a question then, Dan? Why do you think not so many people feel called to go into to orders these days?
I don't know. I think the best thing the Catholic Church can do is to have allow priests to be married. I think that's the worst thing that has happened to them. That's been the demise of the place. And that's why, look, you know, you can't, a fellow has inherent instincts and what have you, and I don't think that being celibate is a natural phenomenon. I might add, too, that I was a member of St. Patrick's Cathedral Choir for 13-odd years, and I know that through the annals of time, it's been indicated that, you know, a lot of those choir boys that were sexually assaulted and abused by the persons responsible for them, but that I witnessed none of that. And, you know, I spent the last 37 years of my life as a high-ranking police officer, and, you know, it never came to me that such things that, you know, have happened to any of my colleagues or friends during my education or my time in the choir.
Well, Dan, thanks for those observations. Jude, did you want to respond to anything Dan's had to say there?
I think what, and Dan, thank you very much for your comments, and I think it shows the heralding of the heritage that many religious across the congregations have actually given to people within and beyond the church, while also acknowledging the pain that some people have experienced. But we need to make sure we announce the good news as well as also enter people into the history of the pain.
Mm. And it's a case of owning the whole thing. I think, Nolan, you were referring to this before, that we can't be in denial, nor can we be overly optimistic or simplistic. We've got to actually be total about ourselves because we're human.
Mm. I think, too, his comment about celibacy, for the priesthood, it's a regulation in a sense. Yes. But for religious life, it's a free choice.
It's a calling.
It's a calling and a choice that you make.
Yes.
Willingly and as part of the whole vocation.
Yes. And and many people would say, well, that's perfectly fine, mm-hmm. you know, and it's going to be very healthy and all of that. So the issue over being celibate or single in the religious life is not quite the same as the debate you're having over the nature of the priesthood,
not
because
at all.
You're involved in a whole different set of theological discussions then.
Yes.
So we should make that clear, folks, if you want to raise that issue again. Thank you very much for your call, Dan. We got a number of calls on the board, so let's get on with them. Terry in Ashfield in Sydney's got an interesting observation. Hello, Terry, welcome.
Hello, John. Hello, Jude and Nolene and Claire. I would like to ask, how can we stop the swell of fundamentalism within the Catholic Church with our Cardinal and also with the Pope? How do we bring, and with the talk, you know, of the Third Vatican Council, disregarding the Second Vatican Council, how do we stop this swell of encouraging young people to go into orders with the fundamental mentality? How do we stop it?
Okay, well, look, we'll split that question a number of ways, because you actually raised a couple of issues there. One is this question, and I think it's raised perfectly relevantly. You have a tendency in the world at the moment, as people are leaving the church, and it's happening, those people who remain are more conservative than those who have gone before. So you've got already got the seeds of a dispute. You can see this happening in Protestant churches. You can see it happening particularly in American mainstream churches. They're wrestling with the change. But there's another debate here too that the Catholic Church is having with itself about what was meant by Vatican II, what is meant by being modern, and also, dare I say, another issue that was raised by World Youth Day, in which a number of people came to Australia representing quite conservative traditions, almost back to the old enclosed orders, and have proved to be groups quite capable of attracting young people. Is there a sort of sense of certainty that some groups offer that really perhaps may not be healthy?
I have a friend who calls fundamentalism the lust for certitude, and it's got nothing to do with faith. That faith is what it is. It's about trust in the mystery of God and trust in the gospel for Christians. And so, yes, it is a challenge, I think, for the church at this stage, because there's something in our human nature that wants certainty and wants it to be all packaged, and where that challenge is not there to live your life daily by faith in the mystery of God.
Did you feel, any of you feel a bit affronted by those vociferously campaigning? I think most of them were American groups who came out, conservative groups within the church out here for World Youth Day, saying, look, come and join us, but were sort of presenting themselves in a very 19th century sense. Nolene?
Look, for me, really, the call to live my life this way, it's not something that I would just jump on a group like a bandwagon. It's when you might initially get caught up. I don't think I was confronted by those groups, but I probably thought, well, it can all be a bit silly, because there is no point in just building up the emotion of what this life is about, because that won't last. If you're going to live this life, it is something that you just have to do.
It's a mature decision.
It's a mature decision, but it's just something that eventually you know you have to do. It's something I'm going to do, and it's not something that I could explain to people why that is, but it's something I knew I was going to do, and I also knew where I was eventually, which group I was going to, because something in the spirit of myself identified with something in the spirit of that group. So I think, look, young people will explore many avenues, but if they have good counsel, they over time will come to a mature decision about that. And if they don't, really, it won't last, because you can't live this life on emotion.
Mm. Can I just take up the point of Nolene? I think the big contrast is between the fundamentalism and the more mature approach to religion. And I actually am not sure which is, like, I think we have to be careful in distinguishing between the most dominant voice of times and the most pervasive. And I actually have more conversations and interact with many people who have a very mature approach to faith and to life. Now, it's a question whether that is sufficiently across the discourses in the church and in the community, but for me, that's the most pervasive conversation I'm part of. But we need to make sure that we lead people beyond any infantilism in approach to religion.
Let's go to Maureen in Brisbane. Hello, Maureen. How are you?
Oh, good, thank you.
What would you like to say?
Oh, well, I'm just going to make mention of the religious orders in Australia, and some of them, particularly the Joseph. You know, recently there's been a lot in the media with the canonisation of Mary McKellar. And, you know, I noticed that you actually, from a distance, you cannot tell these. They don't stand out as sisters of St. Joseph, you know, where they're no longer wearing the habit. And I know that they're not the only ones who have, you know, done away with the habit. I recently experienced, a few months ago, I was speaking to just a lady in a shop, and it was looking at it for quite a while before
We're getting some breakup in your call. I think we've got the sense of your question. So rather than sort of endure the breakup, we'll repeat the question. It's about the order, wearing of distinctive garb.
Well, I think it's a question of identity, actually. Yes. And so how do people express their identity and how do people actually perceive identity? And, like...
Kids love brands, don't they? I mean, every kid wears a T-shirt with a brand on it. So it's not a question of branding, is it? It's not a question of, you know, the badge. It's a question of the style of the badge, is it?
Well, it's a question of what that is saying about yourself. Yeah. And it also goes back to your point, too, about, like, we are part of the wider laity and we need to be careful not to separate ourselves out while still having a clear identity as a person who's a religious. Mm-hmm. And the habit can actually, for many people, give a separation that takes us beyond that sense of being one of the people of God.
And if we talk about a spirituality of relationship, well, it's the relationship that I have with people. It's not my visibility because of I dress in a garb that belongs to another century.
But visibility can be useful. Okay. If people respect you and they see the visibility, they know that you can be approached. They know that they can go to you and say something or ask you for something or...
Look, I think people find us anyway, John. I'm sorry to have to tell you. When I was first going out on the streets of King's Cross and into the pubs and the nightclubs, it wasn't very long before everyone in those pubs and places knew exactly who I was. And in fact, for me to be there in a habit would have been a distinct disadvantage. I don't think anyone would have come and sat with me because going as I was, people could come and sit with me and have a conversation without necessarily everyone in the place being aware of it. But if I had been sitting there in a full habit...
Might have
thought
you in dress-ups.
In dress-ups, they definitely would have thought, and in fact...
That you were there in drag.
They would have had trouble distinguishing me from those who were there in dress-ups as nuns.
Thanks for your observations. Let's take a call from Anne in Victoria. Hello, Anne. Welcome to you. What would you like to say?
I've got three things to say. One...
Very briefly, if you could.
Yeah, right, I'll try to be as brief as possible. One, I was actually a member of the Good Sam Order, so Claire Condon's Order.
Yeah.
And I found the training there didn't really prepare me for a religious life. It was pretty harsh in 1969. And Vatican II hadn't seeped through. I mean, the big thing was our habit was going to be sort of 2 inches higher. So
big change.
That was one thing. And I left because the vow of obedience was going to be the killer for me. It wasn't chastity. It was obedience. Somebody telling me I would have been very rebellious. Two Christian brothers. I have a cousin who's a Christian brother, and at the age of 64, he has been now a missionary in Tanzania, headmaster of a school of 1,000 pupils. Totally different experience to an Australian Catholic secondary school. And thirdly, this weekend, I've had the most joyous experience of seeing a young deacon ordained to the priesthood who has left his homeland of Poland, seen the need for priesthood in the Diocese of Sale, which is rural and suburban, and he has, you know,
sacrificed his life for that. And we're going to have to wind you up there because we're running out of time. We've only got 45 seconds left. The hour has gone stunningly quickly. We have yet to scratch the surface of most of the issues that we'd like to talk about. Look, it's been wonderful to have you with us. You must come back again and talk to us. And we'll talk one time about how you get sort of people to join up. It's been great to have Jude, Claire and Nolene. Jude and Nolene, with us this evening, and Claire as well. You're on Sunday Night. We'll be back after the news.